I'd like to welcome you to the 1999 PD Leak Public Lecture. My name is Michael Power, and I am the PD Leak Professor of Accounting here at LSE and Head of Department, Head of the Accounting and Finance Department. Before I introduce this evening's distinguished speaker, Professor Niels Brunson, I think it's appropriate to say a little bit about Leak himself. Percy Dew Leak was a British chartered accountant who ran his own firm and became a fellow of the Institute in 1883. He took a keen interest in all matters relating to the profession, and he wrote widely on many issues, particularly those related to asset valuation, depreciation, and goodwill. These are, of course, subjects which may remain as controversial today as they were for Leak himself. Leak was that unusual combination, a thoughtful practitioner with scholarly as well as practical instincts. There was a PD Leak chair in accounting at the University of Cambridge until 1980, and I'm very proud to be holder of that position now at the LSE. When he died in 1949, Leak left a large sum of money in trust to the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales for the purposes of supporting accounting education and research. A great deal of this money was administered by the research board of the Institute until recently, but that body has now been transformed into the Centre for Business Performance. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank both the Centre and the Institute's trustees publicly for supporting this evening's lecture, which is the first part of a roadshow which continues in Oxford on Wednesday and Thursday. So it now gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this, the third PD Leak lecture in the present series. Professor Niels Brunson is Professor of Management at the Stockholm School of Economics and Chairman of the Stockholm Centre for Organisational Research, otherwise known as SCORE. Professor Brunson is very well known to us here at LSE. His work represents and extends a long-standing and distinctive tradition of Swedish organisational and management research. Brunson's distinguished and distinctive research endeavours are united by an interest in the complexity of decision-making and human behaviour in organisational context. This work takes its lead in part from the work of March and Simon, but Professor Brunson has extended the framework of these earlier analyses of organisational decision-making into new areas and in new ways. In particular, he focuses on the needs of organisational actors to legitimate their behaviour, and he is the author of many books and papers on this theme, one of which is provocatively titled The Organisation of Hypocrisy, Talk, Decisions and Actions in Organisations. This is in part an exploration of the inevitable gap between the reality of organisational decision-making and the ideal typical stories that participants, textbooks and policymakers must tell of what is going on. In this respect, his work is very important for any manager or policymaker interested in the fortunes of newly installed accounting and budgetary systems. More recently, he is also the author of The Reforming Organisation. Though based more in management and organisational analysis than accounting itself, his work clearly has obvious and direct relevance for accounting change in public and private sector organisations, the subject of his lecture tonight. And finally, he's now engaged with colleagues in Sweden and around the world on a major and exciting project on standardisation, a project which takes a close look at the accounting standardisation process itself, but locates this in a broader system of regulatory projects from which I think accountants can only learn. This evening's talk is entitled Accounting and Organisational Reform in the Public Sector. And so without further ado, I'm very much looking forward to this lecture. I'd like to introduce the presenter of the 1999 PD Leak Distinguished Lecture, Professor Niels Brunson. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here and that you want to share some ideas with me at this late time. I have been brave or maybe unwise enough to choose a topic for my speech today which is more empirical than oriented to some sort of neat model. So I will present to you empirical data and analysis of empirical data, and empirical data are often more blurred, complicated, and more uncertain than things that we can put into our models, and that will maybe reflect a little bit in this talk. Well, the empirical data come from the substantial reforms that we have seen in the public sector in many Western countries the last two decades. These reforms seem to have been particularly common and radical in countries like this one, and in the one I come from, as well as in countries far away like New Zealand and Australia. But reforms, I would say, have been common all over Europe, at least in countries such as France, Finland, Italy, and so on. A great many of these reforms have not been aimed at the products of the public sector, at directly improving activities such as healthcare or education or so. Instead, they have consisted very much of attempts of changing the modes of managing, the modes of controlling and accounting for the production of things. They have, of course, varied somewhat between countries and sectors, but there are many similarities among them. The reforms have included attempts at deregulation, of reducing centrally decided rules. One has striven for more autonomy at the local level, at the level of individual public services. A new group of local managers has arisen, officers who are supposed to make more autonomous decisions for their units. They have developed local objectives and special policies for their entities. These reforms have involved a heyday for accounting, in particular management accounting techniques, and for experts in such techniques. New budget procedures have been introduced where allocations have been less specified. Forms of accrual accounting has been installed. Evaluations and audits have become more and more popular. In some cases, contracts are formulated between the central and local levels. Some entities are to act as purchasers and others as providers of services. Citizens are assumed to choose among partly competing public services and some services have been privatized and so on. All these ideas, they seldom come isolated one by one. Instead, reforms tend to come as packages. They include many ideas at the same time. Or in other cases, the reforms have come in strings. Some aspects are reformed first, but these reforms give rise to claims for further reforms. Such packages or strings of public sector reforms have even been given collective names, such as the new public management or things like that. These reforms have had many enthusiastic supporters. Even more people have found them sensible and natural. They have been initiated or backed by governments of very different political shades. In most cases, I would say that the resistance has been relatively weak and opponents have had little success. In many cases, the reformees have become reformers themselves. Managers of local units under reform have demanded further reforms in the same direction. Even clients or citizens have directly or indirectly supported reform. And of course, one can put many questions to these developments. What has really been happening here? Why has it been happening? Why during this special period? Why in so many countries? Why so massively and extensively in some countries like this one and Sweden? These are the kind of questions I will discuss tonight. I will not promise to give any definite answers, of course, to those questions, but I will at least touch upon them. In my interest here, I'm not alone. All these remarkable events have been followed by a considerable amount of academic literature in which they are described and where one has tried to find explanations. And as you know, colleagues from this school has made major contributions to this field. Students of these reforms have described them in several ways. For instance, as the result of new or liberal policies, ideas, or the result of the shift in ideals away from hierarchy and the state and towards the market and the business firm, or of increasing tendencies toward rationalization, a tendency to put a figure on and to account for more aspects of human life, or simply as the result of fashion. So there are many interpretations, and today I will add one more interpretation. I will argue that these public sector reforms can also be interpreted as organizing, as efforts to construct organizations. The reforms can be described as ways of turning public services into what we mean by organizations. That explanation can, of course, be seen as a complement or as an alternative to the other explanations. And I will divide that argument into three parts. First, I will try to demonstrate that the contents of many of the public sector reforms reflect the concept of organization. Reformers have turned public services into organizations, or at least into something that resembles the abstract concept of organization more than before. So that's my first argument, which is a descriptive argument mainly. Secondly, I will argue that the concept of organization has not only characterized the contents of many reforms, it has also inspired the attempts of reforms. The concept of organization can be used for explaining why reforms have been launched at all, why they have been launched so massively in packages or in strings, as I said, and why the reforms were accepted so widely and so easily. So that's my second task, which is more explanatory. And thirdly, I will come to speculations. I will try to speculate a little bit about how it comes that the concept of organization, as I will argue, has become so important in our time. So these are the three arguments in front of us. So first, the reform organization as reform contents. Well, in order to discuss this, we first, of course, need to define organization. What is an organization? That is not a trivial question. We tend to discuss organizations as we discuss things, trees or buildings. And I think it's important to remind ourselves by and then that no one has ever seen an organization. An organization is not a thing that we find when we look around. It is something actively constructed by people. There is an institution of organization. That is, that we all share some ideas about what an organization is, what characteristics are typical for an organization. There are some specific types of activities going on and some specific types of relations between people which we think as typical of organizations. And in order to call something an organization, these characteristics have to be present. That we share these ideas make it fairly easy for us to create an organization, to set up something that we all agree is really an organization. What we have to do then is to establish the characteristics that we think are typical. And the characteristics that I think are typical of organizations, I think, can be summarized under three fairly abstract headings, which I call identity, hierarchy, and rationality. I will argue that the real organization is something that has a specific identity, and identity has to do with aspects such as boundaries, autonomy, peculiarity. Organizations also have some kind of hierarchy and show some degree of rationality. What I will do now is to try to explain to you what I mean by these concepts, and at the same time, I will try to demonstrate that these concepts and ideas have been important aspects of public sector reform. First, as I said, in order to we have organizational identity that has to do with autonomy, with boundaries, and with peculiarity. If we are to believe that there is a real organization out there, such characteristics should be present. And many public sector reforms have precisely attempted at installing or reinforcing these aspects of identity in public services. First, autonomy. An organization is an entity that has some certain degree of autonomy. This involves the right to decide for oneself. And in many countries, attempts indeed have been made to reinforce this aspect in public services. To increase the local autonomy of local public services, for instance, schools, universities, hospitals, local governments, and departments within the state, One has, as I said, tried to reduce the number of central rules and make them less specified. Instead, decisions are to be taken within the local unit. The task for central bodies is increasingly framed as one of giving advice and follow-up rather than to give directives to local units. The autonomy aspect of organizations also involves the ability to own or at least to control resources, as well as the ability to control organizational boundaries, for instance, by controlling the opportunities for entering or exiting the organization. And these aspects of organizations are also reflected in public sector reform. Employment regulations have been reformed in many cases. Staff is now employed by the local school, the local university, the department, instead of, as before in many countries, by the state or by the local government as a whole. Conditions of employment are now often determined locally rather than by central or professional regulations. Reformed budget procedures have aimed at giving local units and their management more independent control over resources, allocation, and operations. Integrated funding has been introduced. Higher levels do not specify how much of the budget should be used for example, rent, personnel, technical equipment, and so on. Instead, this is assumed to be decided by the local management. Some public services have even been allowed to acquire and use income from other sources than central funding at their own discretion. The existence and control over local organizational resources is even more emphasized with the introduction of forms of accrual accounting. The accounting is made now in terms of costs and achieved results rather than in terms of expenditures. Result centers have been defined and attributed assets and debts according to a balance sheet. The result centers are treated, not formally, but practice as owners of resources, and they are assumed to bear the full cost for these resources. And of course, in other cases, the autonomy has been increased even more when units have been transformed into publicly owned companies or have been privatized. An organization is also defined by boundaries between the organization and its environment. A distinction is made between what is happening inside and outside the organization, and these things are evaluated differently. That's also an important aspect of the concept of organization. And this is, of course, the main task for any accounting system, to define, specify, and maintain that boundary between the organization and its environment by defining the costs, income, assets, results, and so on, that are internal and those that are external. And indeed, with these recent reforms of public services, many local entities have been asked to define their boundaries and their environment in policy documents and in their accounting. Also, as I said, the identity of organization also involves the idea of being special, the idea that one organization is different from others, that an organization has certain characteristics or combination of characteristics that are different from those of others. The organization has a special task or a special purpose. It has special features, special competence, special resources, and so on. And this aspect of organization also shows up in public sector reforms. Entities in the public sector have been asked to formulate their own objectives, their own policy statements, performance reports, where they all emphasize differences between themselves and other services. For example, individual schools, maternity wards, universities have formulated their own profiles. Some have actively marketed themselves with the help of these profiles, their own logos, and sometimes even new names that emphasize their special identity in order to get more customers. But an organization is also defined by conceptual boundaries. A real organization tends to be called by the term organization, that is being presented as belonging to the category of organizations. Again, this idea can also be found in some public sector reforms. In some cases, reformers have actively used the term organization for public services. Rather than using the old categories, such as schools, hospital, authority, and so on, they have called the entities organizations. And in some British and New Zealand policy statements, it has even been stated explicitly that public services should be regarded as organizations, no different from other organizations, like companies or labor unions and so on. And I think related to that shift of category, is a shift in the base for recruiting leaders and personnel. New leaders for schools and hospitals and so on are not only recruited from other schools' hospitals. There are, in many cases, explicit policies have been formulated to recruit public service managers from other types of organizations. The library manager does not need to be a librarian, the rector does not need to be a teacher, and so on. And it has, in many cases, been seen as a problem that there are so many leaders in the public sector without experience from non-public organizations. So all these aspects, right, are aspects of organization that one has tried to install and or reinforce into the public sector. And they all had to do with what I call identity. There have been attempts of reinforcing organizational identity, the autonomy, the boundaries, the special profiles, and the category of organization itself. And all these are aspects of the concept of organization. Another aspect of the concept of organization is hierarchy. And reforms have introduced more of local hierarchy in public services, typically. And hierarchy has to do with coordination. Organizations coordinate activities. The ability to coordinate action is, in fact, often seen as the very point of organizing. The special identity of the organization is to be transformed into action by way of hierarchy. Management is to see that the organization fulfills its goals. So by hierarchy, the identity is transformed into action. That's a very strong idea about organizations. And constructing an organizational hierarchy means emphasizing coordination within the organization. It means stressing that there is an organizational management which is in control and therefore bears responsibility for the organization and its activities, and that this management has a considerable freedom of choice. Exactly constructing such a local hierarchy within the local services has been the objective of many public sector reforms. Reformers have tried to strengthen the cooperation within the local unit by creating teams composed of various personnel categories and professional groups, coordination within hospital clinics, state authorities, and so on has been reinforced, while coordination between these entities, between clinics, offices, and authorities has been reduced. And all this coordination, of course, should be guided by organizational policies rather than by central rules or professional norms. And several public service reforms have aimed at quote, letting managers manage, unquote. Chief executives are defined as managers with freedom of a choice rather than as civil servants who follow and implement central directives. And these managers are supposed to launch their own initiatives, to design activities, and to transform the entity so that it becomes something special with its own special characteristics. Managers become leaders and are being trained in leadership and strategic management. And top management is supposed to acquire that control with the help of various management accounting techniques. So again, one can see again how aspects of the concept of organization is reflected in these reforms. And another aspect, and the third aspect that I said of organization is rationality. That is the idea that executives try to systematically forecast their preferences, action alternatives, and their consequences, and allowing the comparisons between these factors to determine their choice of action. And it's easy to find examples of rationality in public sector reforms. When I try to install, for instance, various forms of management by objectives, the idea is that objectives that are specific for the individual service should replace rules that are determined either outside or inside the entity. And it's assumed that these objectives would then control actions, and it should be registered, of course, whether these objectives are actually reached. Rationality is easier to achieve if the organization has one objective, or at least only a few objectives, rather than many. If there are a lot of objectives, it's more difficult to determine by rational means what is the best action. And I think I've seen that the recurrent complaint in reviews of public sector entities has been that they have several tasks and objectives, which may be partly contradictory. And a number of reforms, not least in my country, have aimed at dividing agencies into smaller units with fewer objectives in each unit. For example, separating them into inspecting and service providing units, purchasing and providing units, producing, inspecting, and advising bodies, and so on. So it's more of one objective, one unit, rather than one unit, several objectives. These demands for rationality also include a need for justification of past actions. Objectives and action are assumed to be connected in systematic ways. Organizations, as you know, are expected to account for their actions in terms of highly rational justification strategies. And they are expected to be efficient or to claim efficiency and to reach their objectives at minimal cost. And this is also reflected in public sector reform. Results of public service operations are increasingly controlled by means of accounting or audits. Previously, accounting in public sector was seen in many instances as mainly a way of registering revenues and expenses, and it's now regarded as a device for checking results. And these demands for certain results have been specified often in such detail that they actually regulate things as much as the rules did before. But the difference from the rule situation is instead that the focus on results makes the local leadership responsible. Managers' freedom to choose makes them responsible for results. They become so-called accountable managers. So by this long enumeration of various things, I've tried to argue that public sector reforms have propagated various aspects of organization. That means that public entities by these reforms have been reconstructed so that they have become organizations, or at least more of organizations than they used to be. And one can see that easily if you want to compare that with other efforts to construct organizations, which are very similar to these reforms. For instance, when one tries to form an organization from scratch, one uses the same kind of aspects and ideas, or when companies try to form one company out from several others that they have merged, they use the same kind of aspects. But when we construct organizations in the public sector, I would say that normally represents an attempt at a major change. Most public services have not been organizations before, or at least they have not been complete organizations. They have had much less of local identity, hierarchy, and rationality than a real organization should have. I will describe that by using some other concepts to describe them. I would say that they have in the past, instead of organizations, there have been what I would like to call agencies or arenas rather than organizations. When they have been agencies, it means that they have been agents or instruments for higher, often political levels in the state. And an agency in this respect, with this meaning, is if we compare that to a complete organization, an agency is lacking in many of these organizational aspects. The identity of an agency is unclear or weak. Resources and terms of employment are typically controlled by the higher level. Agencies within the same field, for instance, police districts or tax authorities, are often assumed to be similar or even copies of each other, to be organized in the same way. Agencies are supposed to follow centrally given rules, which leave little room for any local intentions and rationality. Local management in an agency typically has restricted opportunities for influencing the agency's goals, its structure, its working procedure, or its results, which means that their responsibility is also very limited. Responsibility resides mainly with the principal for, for the agent, for instance, with the politicians at the top of the state structure. But so for an agency to become a real organization, it's a large step. It has to become complete in the sense of exhibiting all the organization aspects. It has to be given clear boundaries, greater autonomy, more control over recruitment and resources. It has to have a local management with a fair amount of discretion, and so on. And this is exactly what these reforms have aimed at producing. In other cases, public services such as universities and hospitals, for instance, have been less of agencies. Instead, they have been what we could call arenas for various professional groups and interests. In hospitals, the professional norms of doctors have been important. In schools and at universities, teachers or scholars have been important rather than the central local policies or central local managers. So arenas like the traditional university or a traditional hospital, they carry the identity of the professions involved rather than a specific local identity. Members carry out their professional tasks relatively unaffected by local leadership. An arena may, of course, be fairly autonomous vis-a-vis higher bureaucratic levels and versus the political level, but its autonomy in relation to the professional norms is small. And these professional norms and rules also create similarities between units associated with the same profession. So it's hard to claim that one is so special as an organization should be. So there are many organization aspects that are lacking in an arena, and all these aspects can be and have been when I've tried to add them to arenas to make them into organization. Agencies arenas, compared to the, if you compare them with the concept of organization, they may have a few and weak organizational characteristics, but far from all and not to the extent that the complete organization has. The reforms provide agencies arenas with more organization characteristics, they turn them into more complete organizations. When these reforms have been extensive in a state, it has changed the state and government radically. Where earlier there was a state bureaucracy within some parts a strong professional influence, we now get a network of separate organizations. Instead of one organization, the state, we get many organizations. Instead of hierarchical relations between these parts with services, we get competition, cooperation, or market relations between highly autonomous parties. And that's a major, when this has been installed, this is a major thing, I think, shift in how we see the public sector or the state. So, by this long description, I've tried to convince you that there is some relation between the concept of organization and these reforms. That is, that the contents of many reforms reflect various aspects of the concept of organization. The next question, of course, is whether all this is a coincidence. It just happens to be that. Or if there is a causal relation between the concept of organization and public sector reform. I will provide some indications of such a causal relation. That is, I will argue that the concept of organization does not only describe the contents of reforms, but I would suggest that it has played a certain role in producing and reinforcing these reforms. I will argue that all these beautiful management and accounting techniques and other aspects that have been adopted by the public sector have not been adopted due to their internal beauty and natural beauty of themselves, but due to their specific relation to the concept of organization. My hypothesis then is that the concept of organization has been often been the underlying mental image or frame of reference for reformers and for reformees. Well-established institutions, such as the organization, may form a kind of tacit knowledge in society. They influence people's way of thinking, talking, and acting without necessarily being referred to explicitly. The contents of the reforms may have been inspired by a reasoning built on the concept of organization, and it may have inspired such a reasoning without explicit reference to the concept, always. In these cases, the concept of organization is invoked, although not necessarily mentioned. I will argue that this kind of causal relation between organization and reform would explain many aspects of the reform process. So if we assume that the concept of organization has been a sort of explanation also for these reforms, we would be able to explain some peculiarities with these reform processes. First, the concept of organization as a mental image may explain why there were any reforms at all. The argument here is that the concept of organization may create a problem and therefore a need for reform. There is not necessarily anything problematic about being an agency or arena. For instance, agencies can be and have been seen as part of the perfect bureaucracy. Nothing problematic at all. Only when these entities are measured against the concept of organization does their weakness as regards identity, hierarchy, and rationality emerge as a problem. That is, the concept of organization is creating the problem. In a comparison with the general and abstract concept of organization, public services that appear as agencies, arenas, seem incomplete. They are short of certain aspects that a real full organization should have. And this incompleteness then can stimulate reforms that help construct organizations. So that's if this hypothesis about the causal relation between the concept of organizational reforms is true, we could explain that aspect that reforms are at all made during this period. Second, the concept of organization as an explanatory variable may explain the relative smoothness of the reform process. I will argue, you may not agree, but I will argue quite strongly that in most instances in most countries, the reforms I've described have been launched over a very short period of time with conspicuous smoothness and little resistance if one compares it to the radicalness of these reforms. So even if you, I know that the collected British academia have been opponents of these reforms and so on, but I still would say that compared to the radicalness, they have been very easy to make such radical reforms. So, and with a few exceptions, the need for the reforms have often appeared self-evident, and the reforms themselves have not required many supporting arguments. Many governments have, of different shades, as I said, have introduced them. And that kind of process can often be found when we change from one institution to another. When people find themselves in an institution that is different from the one they were in before, they tend to change their norms, their beliefs, and their behavior much more quickly and more dramatically than they usually do within a given institutional setting. So I would argue that the relatively smooth reform processes here are due to such an institutional shift, to the introduction of another institution than before, that is, the organization. The organization is a well-known institution. Once people recognize this institution, you don't have to mention it, once they recognize it, they are likely to have similar ideas about what should be done and what the problems are and so on and so forth. And that facilitates strongly collective change. So that's my second argument for my hypothesis. Thirdly, I think the organization concept can explain why the reforms were so extensive in many countries. As I mentioned, one has seldom introduced only one or two organization aspects. Instead, reformers have suggested whole packages of changes or reforms. Or, as I said, they come in strings, together forming a complete or almost complete organization at the local level. And this is what can be expected if the organization concept is what attracts the reformers and reformees, rather than the individual aspects of this concept. And the argument is that the various aspects of organization are likely to appear together or to follow quickly upon each other because they all belong to the organization concept that we all recognize. And this concept and its own logic determine what should be done. A strong local hierarchy presupposes a certain degree of autonomy, for example. The measuring and accounting for collective results presuppose clear boundaries and a certain degree of coordination. Accounting demonstrates results and allocates responsibility. Rationality presupposes objectives and so on. That is, one does not have to gain any practical experience with one organization aspect after the other to see whether they work or not or whether they're good or not before introducing a new one. Aspects follow each other logically rather than practically. It's a logic behind it. So if you have one, you should by logic have the other, and that creates the whole package. If my hypothesis is right here, that they drive, they are driven by the concept of organization. In this way, the concept of organization can expand and reinforce reform attempts also by creating more reformers. If local managers accept the idea that their entity is or should become an organization, they may become reformers themselves. And they have in many instances done exactly that. And reforms can for the same reason be demanded and initiated by others. The discrepancy between a public service and the concept of organization may be perceived by ordinary employees or by external parties who will then generate demands for reform. So all these factors indicate, although not prove, that the concept of organization is not only reflected in the contents of the reforms, but that the concept of organization has also, in fact, inspired reforms and facilitated the reform process. At least this is my hypothesis. Well, that was the second argument. I promised the third one. Or threatened you with the third one. And that follows from the second. If we would accept this hypothesis of organization as an explanatory variable, let us do that for a moment and for the sake of discussion. We have come, obviously, some way when it comes to explain public sector reforms, that they can be explained as efforts to make something incomplete more complete. But we are, of course, far from a full explanation. We still do not know what made people suddenly invoke the concept of organization when thinking and arguing about public services. Why, during a certain period, became people so convinced that was formerly completely accepted as an agency or an arena should now be a more complete organization? Unfortunately, here I have very little evidence to offer. So what I can offer to you are only some speculations why this happened. So don't believe them. But I will give you some to think of. First, we can have a conspiration theory. It might all have been planned. Policymakers and reformers may have chosen a strategy of constructing organizations. A good conspiracy theory would look like this, I think. In the 80s, the public sectors that had earlier expanded rapidly during this century, with some waves up and down of the wars and so on, but I mean, it's an immense expansion. They came in the 80s under strong political attack in many countries, being criticized for a number of alleged shortcomings. and the very size of the sectors, at least in Europe, made them very difficult to control from the top. And bearing responsibility for all that as a politician, while not having much control over it, that cannot have been a very attractive task. So what did they do, these guys, in their conspiracy? Their problem is that in the traditional state bureaucracy, the main responsibility resides with the policymakers, since they are perceived as the only real actors. And the policymakers may have found this responsibility difficult to bear, and the imbalance, as I said, between power and responsibility awkward. And so it may have seemed wise to share that responsibility, or to get rid of it altogether, but at least share it, for instance, with a great number of organizations and their managers, because organizations and managers in organizations, they can also bear responsibility. So that's the conspiracy theory. So they just planned this to get rid of responsibility for something they had little control over. Another speculation could be that the policymakers planned something to generate something, but not organizations. They may, in fact, have planned markets and acquired organizations as a side effect of that. The market became a popular model, as it has never been popular with business, as you know. They try to avoid it all the time. But in the public sector, at least in my country, we have a really enthusiast for markets in the public sector. And markets and market-like conditions have, of course, been introduced into various parts of the public sector. And this may have stimulated the rise of organizations. Why? Because the market requires actors who can supply and demand goods and services, as you know. For the market to function well, it's important that the boundaries between the actors are clearly perceptible. It is necessary to know who owns what and how property rights are transferred between these actors. Market actors must have a certain degree of autonomy, that is. They should be able to choose what to buy and sell and who to deal with. And it's assumed that market actors act rationally in accordance with their own intentions and interests. And a complete organization is exactly, precisely this type of actor that can act on a market. In fact, it's the only actor beside individuals. Thus, complete organizations fit markets better than traditional public services in the form of agencies and arenas. So, paradoxically, if markets are introduced, we can expect more organizations to emerge. Markets have been seen as an alternative sometimes to a strongly coherent state bureaucracy, but markets accord very well with state organizations. Well, a third speculation is that it was not that planned, a fact that may have helped to give prominence to the organization concept could be the popularity of evaluations and auditing. These techniques have become common in the public sector, typically, as Michael can tell us, typically directed towards individual services. A standard evaluation or standard audit defines the unit to be evaluated, its boundaries, its results, its responsibilities. Results are compared to objectives. Responsible managers are identified. Such an evaluation assumes the existence of an organization. Also, directives appear to have become less popular and less accepted in the public sector, as in many other social settings. Instead, there is a greater inclination to give advice. Several national boards in my country have become advisory rather than directing. Their authority is based on expertise rather than on their right to give orders and issue binding rules. And in the European Union, much coordination and control is supposed to be affected by via formerly voluntary standards rather than binding directives. They use standards instead of directives. Well, directives can be given to subordinates and to agencies. Standards and advice require an actor to receive them, someone who can evaluate them and act upon them if they meet with his approval. A complete organization is such an actor. So this idea can also have co-varied, at least, with the idea of organization. Finally, I think the concept of organization as a frame of reference may explain the popularity of private sector companies as idols and models for reform. Many have noted that there has been a certain element of imitation in public sector reform, that images of private sector companies have been used as models. Well, it's first when something has been constructed as an organization so that it becomes vulnerable to further reforms that are common in organizations. That is, the idea of being an organization may lead to reforms inspired not only by the abstract concept of organization, but also by other actual complete organizations. So only if the public service is regarded as an organization, it seems natural to compare it with other organizations. And looking for improvement, of course, it's tempting to compare it with organizations that are believed to be more real and more complete. And that is a typical modern idea about the company. They are viewed in that way. And this may be a factor that have led to the increased what one can call companyization of the public sector. So the import into public agencies or whatever specific ways of displaying organizational aspects happened to be popular among companies at the time. So clearly all these factors that I've tried, all these speculative factors that I've tried to mention do not exclude each other as explanations, of course. And also they can be both causes and effects. They may reinforce the idea of organization, and they may be reinforced by the idea of organizations. For instance, it is easier to imagine markets, audits, and advice if one imagines organization, and vice versa. If one imagines organization, it's easier to imagine markets, audits, and advice. So, to sum up then, I have argued that much recent public sector reform reflects what I have called the concept or institution of organization. And also that this concept, to some extent, can explain the reform process. And I have also tried to speculate somewhat why the organization has become such an important idea. The remaining question that you may have asked early on here in my talk is the traditional one, so what? So what? Does it matter? Are these explanations useful in any way? Well, unfortunately, I leave this for you to decide, mainly. But I will just have a few comments before I stop on that question. The answer to that question is probably different when our main purpose is to study and theorize about practice compared to when our purpose is to change practice. But I think in this case, the two interests of acting and observing have something in common, actually. I think the case of public sector reforms illustrate a phenomenon that has been argued to be frequent in modern life. That is that concepts travel back and forth between theory and practice. So originally, when the concept of organization was formulated, like in the case of many other theoretical concepts, it was formulated on the basis of studies of the actions, descriptions, interpretations of practitioners, people who were acting. Theoreticians learned from practitioners. What I think we are now witnessing is how this concept is traveling back from theory to practice. Practitioners seem to be learning from theoreticians. The concept of organization is now used to determine what is good and bad in practical life, what is lacking, what needs to be done. And thereby we get new problems, new solutions, new actors, and new actions. A theoretical concept in that way is used for developing practice, not only for developing theory. I also think that for students of social life, public sector reform provides another interesting case of institutional change. It can teach us, I think, how a seemingly minor shift in how we understand things may have fairly big practical effects. These reforms can tell us much about in what way and why such shifts in understanding take place, and as well as what consequences they may have. I also think that this discussion may have some more direct relevance for us when we act as practitioners. At least I will mention one, I think, useful conclusion for practical purposes. And that is, if we want to support organizing reforms, reforms that create organizations, or we want to support or perhaps sell some very specific accounting or management technique that is involved, but also, if you want to stop or obstruct such reforms, I think it can be useful. According to my hypothesis here, in order to succeed as supporters, we should support the whole idea of organization, even if we only want to support an isolated technique. In fact, I've seen successful sellers of specific management by account technique doing exactly that, to sell the concept of organization first, and then their technique is easily sold. And for us, or we who want to stop organizing reforms, because we don't like to increase bureaucracy in their wake, or we want more top control or more professional control, I think we cannot argue against the specific details that we do not like, but we have to provide a whole different concept of what public service is about in order to really create any real opposition. And that, I think, is an extremely difficult task. So the reformers can't sleep well, I think. So that's the practical part of it. For those of us who are mainly irresponsible students of social life, the situation is, as always, easier. We could study the supporters and the opponents. We could study attempts at stopping or obstructing the introduction of singular organization aspects to see whether they succeed without invoking a wholly different concept than organization. And if they really do so, I think that could be seen as a rejection of the main hypothesis I've stated in this talk, or at least as a sign that the hypothesis has to be further qualified. In other words, practical action could help develop the kind of theory I have presented here. Thank you.
We do have 10 minutes for questions, so if anyone would like to ask a question from the floor, otherwise I shall do so. It's always a bad idea. Any questions to Professor Brunson?
I've been a practitioner in this business.
There's a microphone just on your right.
I've been a bit of a practitioner in this business of the reforms in the British Civil Service before I left the civil service for some time. And towards the end, I think you said an amusing thing about how the academicals and that sort of thing can observe the scene. My own experience is that this is not totally an academical affair. That is not to say that there aren't a large number of books and a large number of chapters and books devoted to this sort of thing. At the end of the day, British Civil Service, for instance, is a very practical affair. The delivery of public services, I think, costs something like £20 billion a year. This is a highly practical business. Delivery of better service to the public, delivery of better value to the taxpayer, delivery of better accountability to the to Parliament and to the media, all that sort of thing, are extremely important. Thinking back to 1988, when we embarked on our next steps reform, I'm not sure that anything really came out of what was in the minds then of ministers, including in particular Mrs. Thatcher, except some kind of idea, rather unfocused idea, should we say, to do it better. How can we get better value to the public? How can we get better value to the tax? How can we do it better? Small units and all the rest of it were said to be the answer. As it turns out, on the whole and up and down, they probably have been the answer. But we didn't know at the time. I'm just wondering how you actually set out on the... I mean, I know how we set out on these things, I was there at the time, and so were some of our colleagues in the room here. But, I mean, how would you set about it? I mean, what was required there was a feeling of, I think, impatience, which was about, plus a very determined feeling on the part of people who had power that we should make some changes in this sort of thing. It was not actually, dare I say it, to you, Professor Brunson, or indeed any academics in the room, it wasn't remitted to academia for study. It was regarded as a severely heavy, practical business. Let's do a very ordinary, down-to-earth sort of affair rather better.
Yes, I agree with your description that the main impetus here for reform has been that impression that this did not work as well as it should, and it costs a lot of money, and it should cost, we should get more value for money, and so on and so forth. And that has been a very strong momentum for these reforms. What I tried to discuss more here is why the reforms got exactly that contents. I mean, why? Because we actually know very little about how to make organizations better. We know a little bit, but it's a field that where knowledge is very much lacking. So there is not just one way of doing it. So why wasn't one doing it exactly in this way? These reforms and try to do it better in this way, in these ways, and that is what I try to spend my talk on. For us, or for me, as a student of these reforms, that is an intriguing question. One can have used other solutions too. I'm not sure that those had been better in any way. I'm just intrigued by the choice of exactly these measures.
Thank you, Professor Brunson. I work for the Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy here in the UK, but I should say probably the views I express are my own. Interesting, your analysis of why organisations came about. Can I give you sort of two contrasting situations? If you look back at the last government and what happened here over the last 20 years or so, we had organisations, in your sense of the term, in local government at local level. And yet it was quite obvious to most people working in those organisations that the central government agenda turned them into agencies. They had too much autonomy, they had too much identity. Whereas in other parts of the public sector, for example, the health service, which was, in your definition, an agency, it was reversed, that the idea was to make individual autonomous health trusts, which could be much more visible to local people than they had been when they were part of health authorities. But at the end of the day, isn't the key thing here the issue of control? Because even when central government made individual autonomous local hospitals into trusts, they did so in a very prescribed framework of accounting. For example, who would have thought that one of the tests of a good hospital was to make a 6% return on your assets? And now, I mean, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And so I suggest that gives evidence in both ways for your arguments, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, what you have is control mm-hmm. as the thing that's pushing these reforms, and it sometimes suits central government to control by denuding organisations, and it sometimes mm-hmm. suits them to get that control by making a semblance of organisation, but actually the rules are still very prescriptive. And at the end of the day, what you have really is a kind of a shell organisation, which is really tantamount to an agency.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks. Another question. Another two questions. Michael first, and Jeremy.
I'm just wondering if you could elaborate a bit on the implicit argument that the agency model became delegitimated for a reason. I mean, it's not clear what your argument is on that score. Maybe there are bits and pieces of it in the latter part of the presentation. And I'm wondering if your argument about why the agency concept became delegitimated is related to your claim that the acceptance of the organization idea accounts for the smoothness of the enormous scale of change. Could you kind of relate these two parts of the discussion so we can get a better sense of the overall argument here, please?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think my argument was only to compare the concept of organization to the concept of agency. And I think what we have observed in the reforms I'm referring to is that I wanted to change the agencies into something more complete, more of organizations, and that was the sort of while the sort of definitely it was the concept of agency that is the change. The term agency, I think, is used at least in this country in another way, so it's a sort of difference. Yeah. Is that what?
Niels, as ever, you presented us with a very persuasive synopsis of the themes and going on in the public sector and some of the explanations for them. But if I could just go back to the point that was put to you by our speaker but one before. It seems to me that while one can talk about broad contours of change, there are some pretty intrinsic ambiguities within what's going on that, of course, yes. you've had to brush over. Mm. But one of the things that has fascinated me, which I don't think you gave a great deal of attention to until the third part of your presentation, was the nature of accountability on ministers, particularly government ministers, but I'm sure it also applies at the local level, though in the UK to a much lesser extent, for the quality of services that's provided. Because if we go along with your sort of concept of the organisation, there's the role of a minister as a top manager or a chairman of an organisation, essentially concerned with setting the rules of the game, appointing people within the ministry to appropriate positions, setting performance targets and things of that nature, but not essentially being concerned with the delivery of those things. And yet, on the other hand, when things go wrong, ministers suddenly find themselves faced with responsibility for losing a war, for example, or something of that nature. And the whole nature of their actions changes pretty radically to undermine the autonomy to bypass hierarchy, to undermine the autonomy of the agencies and so forth. And I'm sort of struck with the question before one said, well, really, you can see the sort of contours of the changes going on, but in a sense, there's a sort of whole shell going on here which actually keeps control at the top of the organization rather than decentralizing it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, this is an important point. I think maybe I should say that from the outset that I'm not really describing here whether these reforms actually succeeded in changing practice always. They are, I mean, these are images that are constructed by these reforms. And the image is then that the responsibility in this case should be kept at a lower level. But it didn't work. Or in this case you explained, it did not work. It means that people didn't accept this completely, but they wanted to give, well, my speculation was that they maybe they wanted to get rid of responsibility, but they did not always succeed. So so that's it.
Any other questions? Just finally, Niels, I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about some of the mediating agencies who may have been responsible for the rise of this concept of organisation you describe. You don't mention business schools, but maybe you would maybe include them as a sort of potential disseminators of these rather abstract elements that can be taken out and used selectively or together. And even institutions like the London School of Economics are probably not innocent in this respect. So would you see business schools and other types of agencies and consultants taking up these various elements as important disseminators, or is there a kind of, do these elements sort of float freely and get drawn upon by managers and reformers? Yeah.
I would guess that we would most of the time see them more as reinforcers than really creators of these ideas. But I agree that you can, in my country, you can see that together with these changes, the last two decades has been a change in the people, the public sector employs, and they employ more and more people from the business schools. And the fact that they employ more people from the business schools says something about the employer. And also when they employ them, of course, they get easily the certain ideas in there. And I think, at least to my experience, business schools have been very strong propagators of the idea of organization for quite a while. And as an anecdote, I can say that in 1977 I published a book about local governments in Sweden, which was the political scientists were stunned about. There were things written in that book they had never thought of and so on, so they didn't know how to treat that and so on. But what I really did was to think of, it was just very natural for me coming from a business school to think of local government as organizations, and the book is actually about that. And I don't think that book had an influence on it, but it was a reflection on that, and it took me 20 years to understand why it was received in that way.
So you've confirmed your own hypothesis.
Yes.
Niels Brunson, thank you very much for giving this lecture this evening.
Thank you.
And for anyone who wishes, we now adjourn to the fifth floor for a drink and a further chance to ask Niels some questions.